It's an interesting idea, that notion of intimate history. It's so counter to the idea of history as the grand sweeping gesture. And yet what is history if not the sum of its effect on little lives? Intimate history is in the subtitle of my guest's new book, Emma Griffin. She paints a revealing picture of family, of relationships, of work and economic life in 19th century Britain. And it's a book that draws on the autobiographies of over 600 working class writers. And the result of that work, it brings a clear sense of the contradictions of wealth and prosperity, poverty, destitution. These things that were a big part of the Victorian and Edwardian age. Industrialisation, it transformed the world, the lives of many, but perhaps not in the ways we might expect, and often not for the better. Emma is Professor of Modern History at the University of East Anglia, and the book, just published by Yale University Press, is Breadwinner, an intimate history of the Victorian economy. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Before we go anyplace else, congratulations, President-elect of the Royal Historical Society.
Thank you, yes.
That is a wonderful honour. Tell me this. You have written, studied, and researched so much of 19th century Britain. It is your mastermind subject. What is it about the period that draws you in?
Well, I spend a long time studying the Industrial Revolution, which always makes historians fight a lot. Nobody can really agree what the Industrial Revolution was and what caused it and quite when it happened and whether it was a good thing or whether it was a bad thing. But I'd also been working on working class autobiographies during the Industrial Revolution. And in fact, there's a lot of autobiographies for the Victorian period as well. So it felt very natural to just kind of move a little bit further forward in time. And I just loved working with the autobiographies. So I kind of fell into thinking about the Victorian period. And one of the nice things about the Victorian period is it doesn't make historians fight all the time. It's not kind of a big source of conflict.
That's one of the assumptions, though, about that this period, Victorian, Edwardian age, these are times of prosperity, I guess. But yeah. I think you point out here for poor and working class families, that's not the experience.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I came to the project not expecting, I mean, all historians are agreed that Britain becomes a lot richer during the Victorian period, much richer in 1914 than it was at the start of the 19th century. And most people are fairly happy to accept the working class people have started to gain in the benefits of industrialization. So there's a nice simple story there. When I started reading all of these autobiographies, I mean, it is true that some of the families are richer and they're benefiting from all the wealth. But over and over and over again, I saw the same story being told about families that were not rich, that were not enjoying any of the benefits, that were actually kind of very troubled and were even struggling on the most basic level to put food on the table. So I became really interested in what was happening inside those families that meant they weren't really kind of benefiting and they weren't enjoying the wealth and they just were not kind of supporting the story of what we were supposed to expect for the period.
And perhaps this is a thing about the Industrial Revolution we might agree upon, that it hits upon this formula that we see acted out to our present moment of increasing the prosperity of a very small part of the culture while leaving a larger part of the culture not sharing in that growing wealth.
I think that's actually what I saw really clearly in these later autobiographies, is that society becomes much more complex and much more unequal. So this is not at all to say that back in the olden days, society was equal and it was really happy. It wasn't. But it wasn't very complicated because you had a small pool of rich people and then you had masses of really poor people and they all earned pretty much the same. So in your average village, every farm labourer earns 12 shillings a week and there's very little difference between one household and the next. So you have masses of families with pretty much the same level of income. Well, you move into the Victorian city, that is just no longer the case. Every household has a vastly different kind of income. There are jobs that pay really well for working men. There are jobs that pay really badly. But the other thing that you see really clearly in the autobiographies is that many families don't have a man in them at all. And of course, those families are also really poor. And you also have quite a lot of households that do notionally have a man at the top of it, but is not actually very good at sharing his wages. So the whole picture just becomes so much more complicated, and it becomes just very unequal. So you do have working class families getting better off, but you also have masses that are getting left behind. So the whole kind of idea of a working class starts to become much more complicated and unequal, really.
These autobiographies, and tell us about these and the circumstances in which they were written. Was this some sort of a golden age of vanity publishing? Where did these stories come from?
Yeah, so some people write them because they've done something important in life. They've become a politician. They've become a successful businessman. So this is kind of particularly true of men. They do something in life and they write their autobiography. But what's lovely about the late 19th, the early 20th century is you've also got lots of historians by the middle of the 20th century just trying to write down people's memories, just say, you know, just tell us about your life. So people in the 1960s starting with oral history. So we start to get all sorts of autobiographies that are written by people who weren't particularly important and hadn't done anything particularly significant. So that gives us a really different kind of autobiography that exists by this time. And I think that's why these sources really take you into people's family lives, because they're not famous and their parents are long dead by the time they're talking about all of this anyway. So they write about family life in a really different way. And I think that's what made writing the book possible.
And do they have the skill to bring that to life, or does the historian looking at those words, I'm interested in the analytic tools you bring to bear in looking at these stories.
So, I mean, I think that's a really good question, because there are like several hundred of them, and it's really difficult to get handled, because if you've got kind of a few hundred, then you've got everything. You've got really well-off working-class families, you've got really happy families, you've got two-parent families, you've got broken families, you've got everything under the sun. So what I actually did was put everything into a spreadsheet, so I could try and put numbers to, so that was kind of the method that I used. So rather than just saying, well, you've got a bit of this and you've got a bit of that, I tried to kind of count up what kinds of families we had, and that made it possible to establish that around half of all families have a male breadwinner who's in work and shares his wages. But actually, in fully half of all the other autobiographies, you don't. You have other things going on. So it was really, I found it really useful to kind of toss up the totals and to kind of put some state, you know, to really kind of substantiate some of the things that I was trying to say in the book.
I'm tempted to ask you, what were some of the columns in that spreadsheet?
It was a very untidy, very, very long, a very idiosyncratic spreadsheet.
if, however, there are all these stories written by families without male breadwinners, and breadwinner is a term we must return to, but this suggests to me that these stories are written by women.
Well, that's the other thing that's marvellous. So if you're looking at earlier periods, particularly if you've got to publish your autobiography, no one's going to publish an autobiography written by a woman in the Victorian period. So you just don't get autobiographies written by women for most of the period. And then by the 20th century, you've got the emergence of women's history. So you start to have lots written by women. You still have lots written by men as well. But about a third of my collection were written by women. So you start to get, you get some balance. And again, that's very different from the early period where you're really just looking at autobiographies written by men, because women just didn't have the literacy to write autobiographies, and they never had the means to write something and then put it into print. And I think that was a really difficult step before, was to get something published. And when you don't need to get things published in that way, women's stories start to emerge.
And having those stories emerge, we start to then get a different slant on the history of that moment.
You really do. Yeah, that's right. You really see things very differently. So male autobiographies are kind of a very much about a short period of childhood, and then they start work. And then that's so important in a man's life, because male identity is so tied up with work. So very quickly they enter the workplace, and then once they enter the workplace, their life, you know, their whole life opens out. They have these big, broad lives. They have political interests. They have clubs. They have hobbies. They talk about all of these things. Mm. And women's autobiographies are so different, because they often don't work until a lot later. They don't spend very much time working. So a lot of their life is spent in the home. And then, of course, they get married and have their own children, and then they're back in the home. So their autobiographies are all about what goes on inside the home. So very, very different kinds of sources. And when you look at the men's stories and the women's stories side by side, you see what utterly different lives they have. And also how inadequate it is to take some male autobiographies and say, oh, hey, look, this is what life was like in the 19th century. Well, it was for the men, but the women's lives were actually very different indeed.
Let's go to that B word, breadwinner. And this is a term that really, well, it comes to meaning in this moment.
That's right. So, I mean, men had always worked more than women. They'd always worked, they'd always earned more, they'd always had higher rates.
Well, they'd done more paid work, shall we say.
They'd done more paid work, exactly. And when they worked, they had higher rates of pay. There was never equal pay. So they're working much more. So women are often at home looking after small children, doing the food preparation. They're doing a lot of forms of work. It's very hard work doing all the basic things to keep a household running when you don't have electricity. So they're working, but they're not working for pay. And there's this big difference. And in the 19th century, that idea becomes more and more formalized. So it's no longer just that men do most of the paid work. Now people are saying men should do most of the paid work and women should not do paid work. That the household should function with a breadwinner, and that breadwinner should earn a really good wage so that it's enough to support everybody. So this kind of starts to become a much stronger idea in the culture, that men should earn enough to support their whole families and women shouldn't need to work. And of course, that means the opportunities for women to work become even poorer. But as I've already said, so many households don't have a male breadwinner. That leaves women in a very vulnerable position.
And it's interesting too how this sort of notion of familial and therefore social structure that we take as a given is in fact a creation of industrialization.
Yes, I think that's right. That bifurcated family with the man going out to work and earning the wages and the woman staying at home and doing the housework. I mean, there were elements of that in the past, but there were much, it was not a strong binary between what the men and the women are doing. So in the older family model, everybody's doing what they can to keep the household functioning. So for men, that will mostly be going out and doing paid work, but it could well be doing some gardening as well and growing some potatoes. And for women, it will be mostly doing the cooking. But again, it could be looking after the garden and doing a little bit of farming. It could be selling things on a market. So there's this kind of great blurring between paid work and work for the household. And I think that with the Industrial Revolution, that dichotomy between paid work and housework, which is so familiar to us, becomes much sharper.
Suddenly, so society becomes more structured, does it not? And it suddenly society needs to define its roles more clearly.
That's right. That's right. I think things that were always there become much sharper and clearer. Yeah.
For women, I mean, women's work in the home. Give us a picture of that in this period, because it was a very hard life.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly, and that's what I mean. Houses really needed their female labour. They really needed some domestic labour because, I mean, particularly in the countryside, you might be going and fetching all the water that you consume. You might be fetching and chopping all of the wood, all of the fuel. Every time you make a cup of tea, the water has to be fetched. The wood has to be chopped. The fire has to be made from scratch. It's boring. It's dirty. It's heavy. It's hard. And it just takes a lot of time. So you really need women in the house. Of course, you've got no refrigeration. So the food has to be bought on a daily basis. It has to be cooked up on a daily basis. Mm. You just need people who are in the house doing this work. So it's not a question of housework as we think of it today about making the house nicer. This is really just basic work that is necessary if people are to eat a meal to survive. I mean, it's kind of fundamental to survival. So the work is very, very hard. And you need women, basically. Traditionally, it's work that's been done by women.
And you mentioned food there, and this is such an interesting aspect of this world, of all worlds, I guess. But here in particular, I mean, food is scarce. Food is very unfancy. And food within the family structure that boasts a breadwinner is very unevenly distributed.
Absolutely. So the man is bringing in the money which buys all of the food, and the man expects lots of kind of privilege and reward for doing that. So there's loads of examples in the autobiographies of mealtimes and how the first thing that happens at the mealtime is the meat is given to the breadwinner, the man. So he sits and eats the meat. And imagine we've got a stew that's been cooked, and the children and the wife eat the kind of the potatoes and the vegetables and the gravy that are left. So there's a very unequal, I mean, the families really are just very unequal families with very gender divided roles. And everything is unequal. And there's a lot of privilege that comes with being the male breadwinner. You get a lot of privilege for being the wage earner.
What's the tone of women in particular writing about this world? Is there a sense of resentment, a sense of resignation, a sense of bitterness?
I think resignation is the word. I think all my female autobiographers, almost all of them, are just brought up into a world where daughters do what they're told. Daughters do what they're told, and they don't earn wages. So you never get the freedom that comes with earning a wage. So whereas the man will kind of go off, I mean, the boy might start working at the age of 12 or 13. He won't be earning very much by that point. But by the time he's 15 or 16, he's earning enough to live away from his parents if he wants to. He just do what he likes. He's got kind of real freedom. It's not a massive wage, but it's enough wage to give him freedom. But a woman will never really earn enough wages that she could pay for rent and food and live apart from her parents. So she's only really earning pocket money. So she's still very dependent on her family at all times. So they're just utterly resigned to this world. There's no escape route for women. And you see quite a lot of the female autobiographers dream of becoming teachers. That's what they would have loved to do. And teaching is really the only opportunity for a woman to earn enough to live in a house on her own and have a little bit of kind of independence. But most working class girls can't become teachers because you've got to stay at school for years to become a teacher. Yes. And precisely because they're poor working class girls, they don't get to stay at school. They're pulled out at the earliest opportunity. So most of them don't become teachers. But they hanker after this. And it's clearly because this provides kind of opportunities and autonomy for them that nothing else is available. But they are very reconciled. There's not much fighting against it. They're just resigned. This is just the way the world is.
What an extraordinary window into a tough world, but and a world in which we can see the building blocks of our own. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you.
Emma Griffin, she's Professor of Modern British History at the University of East Anglia, and that book, Breadwinner, An Intimate History of the Victorian Era, is published by Yale University Press. We will pop the details for you, obliging people that we are, on the LNL page, on the Radio National website.